And at this time, I'm very happy to introduce tonight's speaker, Jane Reichold. Jane Reichold is one of America's leading haiku poets. She has written over 30 books, most of them on haiku or poetry, including Writing and Enjoying Haiku, a hands-on guide. She is a three-time winner of the Haiku Society of America's Merit Book Award for Tigers in a Teacup, Silence, and a Dictionary of Haiku. She's also a two-time winner of the Literature Award from the Museum of Haiku in Tokyo for original haiku. In 1998, Ms. Reichold was honored with an invitation from the Emperor and Empress of Japan to attend the Imperial New Year's Poetry Party at the Imperial Palace in Tokyo. Since founding AHA Books more than 20 years ago, Jane Reichold has aided the spread and understanding of haiku and other Japanese poetry forms with the publication of over 50 books. She started the magazine Mirrors, International Haiku Journal, edited Geppo, a monthly publication for the Yukiteikei Haiku Society of America, and continues to co-edit Lynx, a poetry journal with her husband, Werner. Her books sponsor the Tanka Splendor Awards, which honors exceptional writing of Tanka poetry in English. She holds memberships in haiku societies in the United States, Canada, Japan, and Germany. Her literary papers are housed in American Haiku Archives of the State Library of California. Please welcome Jane Reichold.
Thank you, Cynthia, for that introduction. And a special thanks to each and every one of you who has made whatever journey you have had to make to come here tonight. I really appreciate that because I don't journey well, and so I'm really touched that you all came tonight. Your being here to celebrate Poetry Month is our common wealth, and I hope you feel that as deeply as I do. Therefore, you are invited to use the question cards not only for your questions, but I would really like it if you would put one of your haiku on there and so that we can hear it. And I think tonight what they'll do is they'll bring the microphone around to you so you can actually read your haiku and so that it's a part of our evening, and that's important. And if you don't write haiku yet and you want to recite a favorite haiku that someone else has written, that's good too. Now, I have a speech that's about 1.5 hours long, and I considered reducing it to 17 syllables and then sitting down quickly. And I figured out that if I don't breathe through the whole thing, I can do it faster, and I'm sure that short-term memory loss will make it just about right. So I've come tonight and brought Basho, or at least his words. And since he is the saint of haiku, I'd like to first clear up some misconceptions people have about haiku. This is where I get hot under the collar, so I need water. Many people think that haiku are not real haiku unless they have 17 syllables. And this does not have to be. In Japan, if you're counting the sound units, there should be 17. But English syllables and Japanese sound units are different. The sound units are much shorter. And so if you would write a 17-syllable haiku, it would come out about one-third too long. One of the ways you can figure this out is when we say Tokyo, we have 3 syllables, but in Japanese it has 4 sound units. And this carries over into all the language. So you have to, we had to find something else to do. We couldn't count 17 syllables. We got too much in our poems. And we found this when Japanese would try to translate the English into Japanese. And here they had these big clunky poems with way too many words. So we've taken the idea of using short, long, short lines, and this conforms to the haiku form, but it allows us the freedom, a little more freedom, in how many words we use. Also in Japanese, instead of having a period or a comma or a dash, they have a word for it. And those words take up a couple of sound units. So that's another way they shorten it. So modern haiku writers think that you should not count English syllables when you're writing a haiku. And this gives you a lot of freedom. It's you know, this is, you can suddenly expand and people are really taking it and running with it. It's very good to see. There's the old idea that haiku cannot be written in English. In the 60s, R.H. Blythe wrote a book. He actually did four books in a series. Probably some of you who know haiku know this book and love it. And in one of those books, he writes that women cannot write haiku. So, here I am. And also, Earl Miner wrote a book about Basho's Renga. And in there, again, he said, it's a beautiful form, an interesting thing to study and to learn about, but we shouldn't try it in English. And this is still the attitude in a lot of universities, that it's wrong to study haiku. They start with the idea, oh, thank you, dear. They start with the idea, well, you're taught haiku in the second grade, so therefore it's something for elementary school. Well, you learn addition and subtraction in the second grade, but that doesn't stop you from studying calculus and algebra. And the same is true of haiku. The more you know about the form, the more there is to learn. And I see some of you nodding your heads because you find that so. So I would like to see haiku or Japanese poetry, Japanese genres taught in universities. Just the other week, I got a manuscript from a professor in a New York State college. And it was her haiku and tanka that she was asking me to publish. And they were so far from haiku and tanka. And it's very hard for me to say to this professor in the university, you're not doing it right, dear. So, yes. But that's my goal. I would really like to see universities study the Japanese genres because I feel there is so much more to be learned. You know, in the 1920s, when the poets began to be exposed to the poetry translations, like Ezra Pound and Amy Lowell, they got this idea of how important it is to work with images instead of abstract ideas. And so they began to use these methods with their own poetry. But they didn't take it far enough. They didn't study the form so that they could write really well. And it is possible, I believe, to write very good English haiku. And I suppose I'll be struck dead if I say it, but I take a Japanese magazine of haiku called Hai, in which they translate Japanese haiku into English. And I would say that what is being written in English is better. Sorry. Because they're working with the ideas of how to build a tanka, or a haiku, excuse me, because we've had to study it so much, and we've had to figure it out. And I think a lot of Japanese people feel they hear the Japanese poems from their childhood, and therefore they can do it. And they can. They bring a spirit to haiku that I don't think we English-speaking people will ever have. Their sensitivity, their grace, their elegance. We can't do that, but we can bring what we are to that form. Another little misconception about haiku is that the plural is haikus. And I know Jack Kerouac said that, and his book says that. But haiku is a Japanese word, and it's not polite, I think, to put our plural S on it. And so it becomes like our sheep, fish, deer, haiku, both. I think one of the early mistakes that people make when they first start writing haiku is they want to tell a story, because we come from a literary tradition of storytelling, and it's hard to stop that. And so it's very easy to say, the door opened, the dog came in, spilled his water on the cat. That's not haiku. Haiku focuses in. It goes right to the very thing. It actually, if this were your poem that you were working with for haiku, you would focus on the point of the water hitting the cat, and that's all you would talk about, because that's what's important in that story. So this is something that it takes a while for people to understand this, and I think one of the best ways of finding out what a haiku is to read them. And reading them is not easy. I found this out. I handed a friend of mine my haiku book. I have published several. And she called me up weeks later and she said, Jane, you know I love you, but I cannot figure out what these are. And she simply didn't know how to read them. And she's an intelligent woman, and I was very surprised. So it is true that people have to learn how to read a haiku. Also, it used to be the idea when they were first introduced that they were epigrams or aphorisms, and that implies that they are one sentence long. Haiku are not sentences. A haiku is built of two parts, the phrase and the fragment. The fragment is usually in the third or first lines, and the phrase combines two lines, either the second and third or first and second. The last misconception I would like to clear up and say, in a positive note, haiku are poetry. When it was first introduced in the United States, they even tried to make it very clear that it was not poetry. And it is. And I think Basho is the one who can show us most clearly that haiku is poetry. When he started writing, and I'm getting ahead of myself here, but at that time, the writing of, they were called hoku in his day, they were like a game or a pastime or kind of a fun thing to do. And unfortunately, this aura still sticks around haiku a little bit. And you see this with the online jokey haiku, you know, and so forth. But Basho took the idea that if you're a serious, deep person, your haiku will be serious and deep. And the interesting thing is that even though haiku is very small, it's the shortest poetry form, it's extremely elastic. You can put in everything that you can feel. And it's only your lack of writing skills that would make that not possible. So, what is poetry? I think poetry is the art of piling up dissimilar images to create an idea that has no exact name. English language, they tell me, has more words than any other language. And yet, think about how many things there are no words for. And I often think about things like love and grief and anything that we experience personally. It's always shifted a bit by our own personality. And the only way you can express that is by using words other than the abstract ideal. It's so hard to describe what the art of poetry is, but one way I can think of it is, imagine a woman standing by an open window, and a bird flies on the windowsill, and she reaches out and puts her hands around it to carry it back outdoors. And while she has it in her hands, she feels the dryness of the feathers. She can feel its little heart beating against her hand. And before she walks out the door, she thinks, oh, if I could just show this to someone else. And so she begins to build a cage of words to carry her experience. She works on these words. She builds the best cage she can. She gets it published where she can. And then someone else reads it. And the minute the reader puts the image from words into images in their mind, her hands with that bird reach through, and the reader can feel what she felt. And the reader doesn't know what the bird looks like. So the reader will open his hands, and the bird will fly free. And there goes the poetry. And that's part of what makes haiku so interesting is that in learning to read it, you have to learn how to build these images. You read the first line, and there's a pause at the end. You get to the end of the line, and the idea is that you form an image in your mind. We all know Basho's old pond frog. Old pond haiku, don't we? Old pond, a frog jumps into the sound of water. So you say old pond, and each of you instantly imagines some old pond. And every old pond in this room is different. And then you say a frog jumps into, and your mind sees a frog. It jumps to the left, or to the right in your mind, or straight ahead. Every one of us imagines a different frog. And then comes the kicker in the last line, the sound of water. And you go, whoop. And you have to think about this. What does he mean? It jumps into its own sound? But it does. If you can make your mental frog jump into the water, you will see it jumps into its sound. Oh, I wanted to share Basho's poem about a bird. It's one of his most famous ones, written when he was very young. On a bare branch, a crow settled down. Autumn evening. On a bare branch, a crow settled down. Autumn evening. So you see, haiku do make excellent bird cages. And they're the perfect size for carrying your ideas too. They're not too clumsy with too many words, so keep them brief. There's not the thick bars of ideas, philosophy. You're not going to teach anybody anything with your haiku. You're going to show them what you have experienced. One of the reasons I'm telling you this is because I want to prove something to you. I believe that every person has the ability to be a poet, whether you think you can or not. Some of you are nodding yes, and some of you are nodding no. But I believe you can. I believe even if you say, oh, I have no talent for that, you don't need talent. You just need to do it and do it and do it and enjoy it, and then you'll do it some more. Some of you may already suspect that you're not that far from being a poet. Maybe you enjoy words, writing, different kinds of writing, playing around with words, seeing what you can make them say. You're very close. And some of you may have even tried to write poems and been unhappy with your efforts. I would encourage you to go back to those poems if you've saved them, read them over, find the best and most interesting part of your poem, and I can almost guarantee you there'll be a haiku right there. So I feel that's what I want people to really believe. I really want people to think, yes, I could be a poet. And it will make your life a lot richer. Yes, I saw a poet nodding in the back, and I think she knows how rich her life is and how poor it would be without poetry. So I think if you can think about learning to write haiku, allowing yourself to write haiku, your life will change. I guarantee you that. Because haiku writing is different than any other kind of writing because it demands you change the way you act and live and think. First of all, it begins where you are, in the present. Kierkegaard said that the unhappy man has no present. And I think much of our unhappiness lies with old memories that are painful or fears of the future. But if you come to this moment, this place where you are, you know, is your chair getting hard? Are you thinking how much longer? All of these things are where you are now. And by thinking about them, you accept them. And that helps everything. The chair is not so hard. Haiku are brief, and that makes them easy to write because you don't have the chance to make that many errors. You always write them in the present tense, so there's none of this past participle something or other. You just keep them in the present, keep them simple, use as few words as you can. Use common words. Don't use the fancy words. The other good thing about haiku is with all this emphasis on being green and environmental, it'll connect you to the world outside. And one of the ways of learning to write haiku is to take a walk. And you'll see things. Things will call out to you. And you'll look at them, and suddenly you'll see something different that you never saw before. Or you'll see a relationship, you know, between the rolling surf and the cloud above. And you'll go, oh, I never noticed that before. Or you'll see something that is very odd, a strange little bug doing a strange little thing. And you'll watch to see what it is. And your whole focus will leave your body and go into that thing. And that is the most freeing thing you can do. I feel you live longer if you do that. We'll see. The other thing about haiku is that they can be and sound extremely simple, but they can hold vast reservoirs of meaning in their layers. Like the Basho poem about the crow. You think, well, so, bare branch, nah. A crow settles down, autumn evening. What he's saying is the way that this big black crow settles down on this bare branch is the same way that it feels when autumn evening comes so quickly, and it's dark and a little ominous. He's got all of that in his poem. It's also interesting that the fact that haiku being so small actually have the most rules. And everybody who has learned it in the second grade, you learn 17 syllables, something about nature, and you think you've got it covered. You don't. I'm still learning new rules. And one of the ways I learned a lot of the new rules was from Basho. Working with his poems has taught me so much. And I would like for that to be your path, too, that you will study Basho and from him learn his poetry. He lived over 400 years ago. He was born in 1644. And this is like, 24 years after the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock. If you think of how the English language was at that time, and then you think that we are still studying his poetry, it is still valid for us. It has not gotten old, and that says a lot about it. Basha was born in a small valley about 35 miles southwest, I think, in Iga Uano. It's now the Mai province. His father's last name was Matsuo, and so we often speak of Basho Matsuo, even though that was not his name when he was a child. He gets his name much later. When Basho was about 12 years old, his father was a samurai for the local lord, and so he got his son a job with the lord as companion to his son, and Yoshida Tada was his son's name, and Basho and he were educated together, which meant that Basho got an excellent education, even though he was born in a rustic rural place. Part of his education was a Renga master would come from Kyoto to teach the two boys about Renga. And I'd like to say a few words about the form Renga. Does anyone here know about it besides John? If you can imagine the haiku, and then think of one person speaking or writing the haiku, and then another person responding with a two-liner. But if you'd think of the middle line out of your haiku, the longest one, which in Japanese would have seven sound units, you put seven and seven together, they get 14 sound units. So it's a collaborative poem form. And one person starts it, and then people vary their participation in it. I just finished one online. I think we ended up with about eight people working on it. So it happens. I would like to explain to you, because Basho was a Renga master, that when he lived, he thought that's all he had and all he was doing. He would travel around from place to place. People who were wealthy would invite him, because at this time, the court was sort of shoved aside by a military government. And these military men were very eager to have culture. And before, it was the court that held the culture. They taught the people, the nobility, how to write, and it was very much accepted part of being a noble. So as these rich merchants would get money, they would want to be as cultured as the people had been in the court. So they would actually hold Renga parties, and they would invite Basho to come. And the host would lay in lots of food, very special items, sake wine, and he'd call in maybe two, four, eight, however many poets there were in the area. They'd come together, and the tradition was the host would ask the best writer in the room to start the poem. And it was very important how a poem got started. It had to have a certain elegance. It had to have a certain complimentary note. It had to contain the season. It had to cover why they were writing it, or maybe what was going on right then. And Basho wasn't always complimentary. In one of his Renga, the hoku starts out something about the house was cold, so he was uncomfortable with it. And instead of being complimentary, the guy was so cold, so tired, so hassled that all he could do was tell the truth. And the house was cold, so that's the way he started. So they would always ask Basha because he was the most famous one. And then the host would answer with a two-part or two-line response. And this was not easy because here was this master and you were hooking up to his lines. And that caused you to do some real thinking. Then after these two were written down, they always had one person be the scribe, and then the poets would offer their links. And maybe two or three people would speak out a three-line part, and then Basha would think it over. And his goal always was to make a complete poem out of the Renga. I don't know, do you know the process of Exquisite Corpse, where you write down a line and you fold the paper and someone writes down a line? It's not like that at all. In Renga, the most important thing is what happens between the links. You study how the links are put together. There is the whole poetry, the whole thing. So you have to know these different ways. I think Basho considered that there were 14 different ways of linking, but now we have a lot more. So he would work on the poem, and when Basho first started to write, the poetry form at that time, the Renga form, had 100 links. They also had 10,000 and 1,000 links. But he found in his meetings, I think they had too much fun or something, but they only got about a third of a 100-link poem done. So, smart guy that he was, he reformed the Renga, and he made what he called the Kaisen Renga, which was only 36 links, so they could have time for more fun afterwards and more drinking. Basho was 18 when he wrote his first poem that we have saved. And I'll read it for you, but I'm not going to explain it to you because it's way too long. It was, "Has spring come or the year gone away? Second last day." And what he was working with was, you know, they had a lunar calendar and a solar calendar, and they didn't always quite mesh. And so some days they had 2 days of the old year. So this is a pretty, how do I say this without somebody striking me dead? But it wasn't a very good poem. And so I hope it gives you courage. You know, write bad poems. If you can't write a good one, write a bad one. So he did. When Basha was 22 years old, his close companion, Yoshidata, took sick in May and suddenly died. And Basha was devastated. He gave up his study to be a samurai. He says that he considered suicide, but his religious precepts would not allow him to do that. But he was devastated, and he disappeared. And they think he went to Kyoto. Nobody knows quite what he did, but he must have studied, because when we hear of him again, he has written a book. And his book is called The Seashell Game. And what he did is, do you know the seashell game as it is in Japan? It's a way children have of finding the prettiest thing. And so they'll pick up two of them and look at them both and say, which one's nicer? Put one in one pile and the other in the other pile, and do this through the whole pile. Then they take the pretty pile and they compare those two, which one's better. And they do this process until they get down to the prettiest shell. And this was one of his ways of judging a haiku contest. He had, I think it was 36 poems. One of them was his own, which he did not give a win to. It lost in the first round. And there, senior lapse. He did this book, and he took it to a Shinto shrine and made it as a present. And I think that's a very beautiful thing to do. I wish our churches had places that we could take our poetry and lay on the altar and say thanks for. Because haiku are gifts. That's one thing to notice. Haiku are gifts. They're not yours either. They come to you. They come through you. They're like children, but they're not yours ever. And that's one of the reasons I don't copyright mine. Because I feel all of my haiku are gifts. They come from outside of me and are given to me from my higher being, a higher being. I don't know, but they are given. So with this new book, Basho then moved to Edo, which is now called Tokyo, and it was to the west and slightly north. And this was a new place. At this point, Kyoto was the capital of Japan, so he was going off to a sort of wild new area. This is where the rich new merchants were. And so he settled down in central Tokyo, and he wrote many books. And it's interesting, the only book that Basho wrote and bound with his own hands was The Shell Game. All of the rest of the books, his whole life through, were done by his disciples. And he gathered many disciples, and they worked very hard. In 1680, oh dear, I see my time is going. He moved to the outskirts of Tokyo. His disciples built him a little hut, they called it, a little cottage. And the next year it burned. And the only way Basho avoided being burnt up was by jumping in the river. So I have much more, but I think I should stop here because I do want to hear your questions. So thank you for your attention, and I wish you blessings on your path into haiku. Thank you.
Would anyone like to ask a question? Well, I'll start. Jane, do you have any of your haiku that you could share with us?
Yes. I'm sorry, I'm pulling the old lady act here. No, I'll just... May I sit? Yes, should I just sit up there?
Okay.
Oh, thank you. One of my haiku. Well, the one I'm working with the most right now is river, above the river, fog. River, above the river, fog. And the reason I say I'm working with that is I'm making a book that is, the pages are 12 feet long, and the letters are 1 foot long, and it'll be three pages and have that haiku on it. So that one's really much in my mind because I'm working on that. So thank you for asking.
You know, years ago I wrote a haiku that has stuck with me, but unfortunately I didn't memorize it, and I have never been able to find it again. And the gist of it was something like, through the hole in my shoji screen, I can see the Milky Way. Something like that. How would I ever find that haiku again? I've looked and I don't know. I can't find it. Well, I don't know where to look.
It sounds to me like it could be one from Issa. And there is a website run by David Linnell, and you can go there, and he has a magnificent search engine on it. You can look up, you can type in, you know, shoji screen and Milky Way. Thank you. Golly, I'm melting, and so the ideas are melting. And the poem will come up for you. So look him up on the web and do a search.
What is the website address? Do you know? Or,
no.
Or how do you spell his name? Let me write it down.
I would just do a search for Issa and Issa translation.
And what was the web? What was his name?
David Lanau. It's L-A-N-A-E-O-U.
Thank you very much.
I saw one of your haiku, the one about carnations and the brazier in winter, that carnations were blooming inside on the brazier when there was a frost outside. And I was struck that rather than a hand clap, there was a gentle finger snap in it. Do you actually consider that when you're translating? To make them more gentle rather than flashing?
I think my goal in translating was to be as close as I could to what Basha was saying. And that's one of the reasons I like the Old Pond poem, because if you translate that word for word, and it comes out exact. And I just feel that, you know, you can make a poem out of what you translate. And I try not to do that. But none of us have the inside track for translation. That's why I welcome many translations. And you should read a lot, because in one book somebody will really hit it on the head, and in another one someone will not. And
it's a good example. You translated it, The Sound of Water, and I've seen it translated kerplunk, which is much more of a, and you did it much more like.
Well, that's the way the Japanese says. It says the sound of water. I mean, it doesn't say the because it's not there. But it is word for word like the Japanese. And this idea of the plop, I think, was it was a way of dumbing down the haiku so English people would admire it. That's my take on that translation. And I don't agree with it. So, yeah, got my say.
Jane, in the appendix of one of the appendix of your book, you have techniques for writing haiku. And I was wondering if those are techniques that you've discovered in your study of Basho and writing haiku, or if they're commonly studied things in Japan. For example, the hidden subject is a common genre for haiku, or is it more things that you've learned in your study?
No, these were techniques that I discovered in my work with Basho, and I felt when haiku was introduced into English language, it was introduced with the idea that you had a haiku moment, and if your moment was holy and good, you would have an excellent poem. And I disagree with that. I believe you can have a haiku moment and not be able to write about it, because my very first haiku moment, I still have not written a good poem about it. And I do feel that seeing Basho's work, I could see these all these techniques that are here, are things I learned from Basho. And I think it's a way of being able to teach people how to write haiku and not just stay with the idea of the moment or the goodness of your inspiration. I want people to take haiku as a way of writing. You have to learn to write. You have to have writing skills. You have to practice them. You have to write and write and write. That's it. So those are my ideas, and yeah. Have they been helpful to you?
Absolutely.
Good.
Very good.
Good.
Another question?
So my understanding is that when haiku are read or recited for the emperor, that they're done in a very melodramatic way.
Yes.
And can you explain that? Or is
you don't want me to do it, huh?
I would like you to, yeah. Can you recite the Furuikeya that way?
What is read at this poetry, first poetry meeting of the new year are all tanka, and I didn't get that far. I got too warm and melted. But you know what tanka is? Does everyone know what tanka is? Okay, imagine a haiku with the two lines under it, like I talked in the Renga. If those five lines were written by one person, that would be a tanka. And a tanka is the oldest Japanese poetry form. Before the language was even written down, tanka was a part of their stories. And the interesting thing is that there's still tanka clubs. People write it today. I know of no other poetry genre that has lived that long. And for that, we must thank the Japanese for their ability to hold on, to value, to honor it, and keep it that long. And we also thank them for passing it along to us in English. So now, back to your question. The poetry party, as it's called, I see it as an outsider, as a report to the gods of the condition of the land. And the way they do this is with poetry, with their tanka. So they hold a contest, and every Japanese person can enter. They pick 10, and those contestants come to this party. And the complete family, the emperor's family, writes a tanka, each of them. And the emperor picks the subject, and they all write on the same subject, and so it's very beautiful. So, you want to know about the reciting. I'll tell you a little bit about the room. It's like four times the size of this and only slightly wider. And it even has a glass up in one end like this room does. And on one end, on one side, like along the wall, are the contestants and the person that comes with them. On the other wall will be the imperial family. In the middle will be the guests, and there are only 100. And you sit according to your age. You're allowed into the room by your age. The oldest one's first, the youngest one's last. And in the middle of the audience is a large table. And naturally, the guests are seated, the contestants are seated, and then there's a knock on these doors, and then the imperial family comes in and sits down. Everybody is dressed in tuxedo and long dresses and very formal. And then a woman comes in that same door, and she's carrying above her head a box. And in this box are the imperial poems. And she takes it and to this table. And these men first read it in Japanese. And if it's a contestant's poem or one of the lower family members, they read it once. And then it is sung. It's in a very sing-song with holding the vowels a long time. And I'm sorry. First it's recited, and then it's recited in a very formal way, and then it is sung. So actually each poem is read three times. But the emperor's poem and the empress's poems are read three times in each manner. So you really get them. And the year I was there, the most touching thing was when your poem is read, you have to stand. And so the empress stood, and, you know, she's so fragile and so, you could tell she was nervous. I really felt for her. And they read her poem, and when they sang it then, the emperor, the whole time he had sat there, and he just stared straight ahead like a doll. And he turns his head, and he smiled at her. It was so beautiful. It was the only human touch there, but it was, and it was, oh, I still get goosebumps by it. It was great.
Are there any recordings of those readings?
I don't think it's allowed. They wouldn't even televise it, but they would let the reporters sit up in the glass room, and they do take some photos. There is a book, it's long out of print. It has the poems for 20 years have been translated, and you might enjoy that book because there are some photos of the room.
I have more of a statement. I've written poems all my life for myself, especially in times of stress, and I wanted to thank you so much for the encouragement, because most of my poems I try to get to bare bones. And I have a feeling that's what haiku is, bare bones.
Exactly, exactly. And the other thing is a lot of poetry is written, like you say, out of stress. But haiku isn't. Haiku is written from your beautiful, radiant moments. Isn't that something that you can have a form to capture the very best thing that happens in your life? And the way you know a haiku is lurking about is if you see something and you think, oh, I want to show that to somebody. There's a haiku waiting. Take that up, look at it, start writing it. You'll find them. They're there. Any other questions?
Thank you. Getting back to the poet, Basho himself.
Mm-hmm.
In your studies, what struck you about him as a person, maybe his outlook in life, his worldview, or his creativity? Can you share what struck you about him as a man?
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing I value most about Basho is his depth and his nobility and the fact that he can take something very simple. He can write about horse piss or mud snails, and yet he is such a noble character that it never slides out of control. And I admired that, because it bothers me when haiku is treated with diffidence, or, you know, just not honored. And he took the form, he honored it with all of his being, and that's what touched me the most about his work. Busan is the other old master from Japan, and he was mostly interested in painting, and so his haiku are often very painterly. Fine, good, yeah. And Issa, you know, Issa's the other one, and a lot of his haiku are things like speaking to a jumping flea. I think he said something like, you know, I'm going now, fleas, you can jump around all you want. And yeah, this is fun and this is good. But Basho had a severity and a depth that I admire. Yes, thank you for the question. Mm-hmm. Also the blossoms, plum blossoms.
Exactly.
He did.
By the way, you can see both influences in it. You can see Van Gogh and you can see Hiroshi Gay in that.
Right.
Print.
Right.
And it seems to me that haiku has had that effect on Western writers.
Oh, definitely.
Well.
Oh, definitely.
An adaption of it.
Yes.
Yes.
Unfortunately, it's interesting that many of our famous poets, as they get older, they turn to haiku. I'm thinking, oh dear. Well, Rilke is one. In Rilke's last years, he wrote haiku or tanka.
Richard Wright did a haiku.
That was the one I was thinking. Thank you. You read my mind. It was right across here. Thank you.
Well, Jane challenged us to write a haiku. Would anyone like to share one of theirs, or perhaps another haiku?
I did one sitting here, and it's that kind of adaption. It's a punk haiku.
Okay, good.
Gothic haiku. Dark sky. Lightning flash. Fire under her black skirt.
Very good. Very good. Thank you. Thank you. See, it can be anything. So by your saying Gothic haiku, you were like putting a title on it, right? Some people do this, and a lot of people don't. Did you feel that this is the way you learned, was by doing that?
By putting titles on
it? Mm-hmm. Do you feel it needs a title?
I felt it was necessary to indicate that it was an adaptation.
Okay. But I really feel that your haiku would be okay without it. It doesn't need the title, unless you think it does. That's a nice thing. As writer, you're always in charge. You can say it is or isn't. You can say it's a haiku, and no matter how it's done, if you say it's a haiku, it is a haiku.
I had a question. In your book, you give guidelines on techniques for writing haiku and ways mm-hmm. to look into haiku. And earlier you said that reading haiku is actually one of the most difficult things for most people, and I was wondering if you had any hints or guidelines for reading haiku and really getting into it and having, for the reader, sharing that haiku moment, bringing that alive through the experience of haiku as a reader?
That's a good question. The techniques can also be a guide to the reader. If you are studied the techniques, it really helps you to say, is this a riddle haiku? Is this, one of the other techniques? And when you understand the technique, then you understand how great what he did with it is. And the techniques were also helpful for me translating, because as you read in the notes, the words, sometimes you don't have much to go on. But if I could figure out, oh, he's going to use this technique here, then I would know where he was going, and then I felt I could better find an English word to equate that. So what I didn't get said before was Basha's death. Could I say a little bit about that? Over the years, Basha made many trips, and whenever the man would get unhappy, he'd make a trip. And this was perfectly in line with Japanese poetry tradition. Poets traditionally went around from beautiful place to beautiful place, wrote poems. Often they were carved in stone, which I think we should do more of in the United States. So he made many trips, and the most famous one he took in 1689, that was his book called Narrow Road to the Far North, or Back Roads to the Interior, has several translations. And he knew this was his biggest trip, and he worked the next 4 years on that book. And it's the most famous book in Japan. And he revised and revised. With him on that trip went a man named Sora. And Sora also kept a journal. And Sora's journal disappeared after Basha's death. They only found it in 1943. And suddenly they were able to compare the day what Basha wrote and what Sora wrote. And so it's really interesting to compare the two. So he worked on this book. He would move back and forth between Tokyo and Kyoto. And then in 1694, when he was 50 years old, he had lost a lot of teeth. He had lost a lot of hair. He walked with a stick. It's pretty evident from his writing that most of his life he had sort of a colitis or irritable bowel syndrome, and going around eating a lot of rich food and drinking a lot of sake did not make it better. And so he was in pretty bad condition.
And I think he knew he was going to die, and he tried to outrun death by taking one more trip. And he got as far as Osaka, and he just fell ill and took to his bed, and his students came from all around and tried to take care of him, tried to do what they could. And I don't know if you know that traditionally in Japan there's the death poem, the poem that you write as you're dying. And so one of his students said to him, you know, he wrote a poem a few days before, and the poem is, "Ill on a journey." Oh. In a weathered field, dreams wander, or something like that. Someone look it up. I don't have it right. I can't remember my own haiku, so it's no wonder I can't remember Basho's. But anyhow, does someone have it? Have him read it. It's the next to last one, yeah.
"Ill on a journey, dreams in a withered field wander around."
Thank you. Thank you. You're kind. But Basho was a revisionist, and that's why he has so not very many haiku, because he kept revising. And so the student said, "Is that your death poem?" And he said, "No, that's my poem about my illness." But he said, "All of my poems are my death poem." Which is really saying something very much. But then he did say one more poem before he died. He revised a poem. And that's also there. It's the very last one. I think it's "Clear Cascade." What's the word? "On the Wave." "Scattered on the waves, green pine needles." Yes. So that was his very last poem. And then he fell into a coma. And on November 28th, around noon, there were many flies flying around. And these students were trying to catch him so they wouldn't sit on him and bother him. And he woke up and he laughed. And he said, "I think the flies are delighted to have a sick old man here unexpectedly." And he went back to sleep and died. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Any last questions? Well, our thanks to Jane Reichold. Thank you so much. Author of Basho, The Complete Haiku. It was wonderful.
Thank you.
Very inspirational. Thank you. And our thanks again to the Japan Society of Northern California for supporting today's program. And, of course, to all of you. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
Jane will be here to sign her books, by the way, which are right out at the front counter. Thank you again, and hope to see you all soon.